Looking to start a podcast but don't know where to begin? Look no further. The team at Dodge Media Productions has 20 years of experience as podcast listeners and observing the industry and 8 years experience in podcast production. We can help you take your podcast from idea to fruition and we'll make the process seamless and easy. We'll help you with everything from recording and editing to hitting the charts on Apple Podcasts. So what are you waiting for? Contact us today and let's get started. DodgeMediaProductions.com.
You're listening to Dodge Movie Podcast. Your hosts are Christy and Mike Dodge, the founders of Dodge Media Productions. We produce films and podcasts, so this is a podcast about films. Join them as they share their passion for filmmaking.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Dodge Movie Podcast. This is episode 161, and we are talking about the 1950 film All About Eve, directed by Joseph Mankiewicz, who also did 1953's Julius Caesar, 1959's Suddenly Last Summer, if that sounds familiar to anyone, and then worked with Elizabeth Taylor again in 1963 with Cleopatra and 1972 Sleuth. He was quite prolific as a director of that era. It stars Betty Davis, Ann Baxter, George Sanders, Celeste Holm, and Marilyn, a very young and new Marilyn Monroe. The DP was Milton R. Krasner, who did Monkey Business in 55, The 7-Year Itch, and in 57, a favorite of ours, An Affair to Remember. Joseph also wrote this film, as well as many other films people will talk of in 1951, the aforementioned Julius Caesar in 53, The Barefoot Contessa in 54, and Guys and Dolls in 55. The synopsis for this film is: a seemingly timid but secretly ruthless ingenue insinuates herself into the lives of an aging Broadway star and her circle of theater friends. And the tagline is, it's all about women and their men.
Not the best tagline.
I know, you know, I had a big, before we go into kind of the what we normally do, I had a little bit of an aha, and I'm curious what your thoughts are. Today I was kind of just puttering, I think, in the kitchen or something. And I've been doing a little bit of research on Betty Davis and also just thinking about my perception of her. And I was quite young, kind of when she was aging out, I would say, of the movies. She wasn't as much in our zeitgeist, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, I don't really remember her having a career later in life. Like perhaps, you know, Katharine Hepburn.
Right. So she very much came off like she was kind of like a bitter, angry old woman anytime I would see her. And I feel bad saying that because that was just from my young, you know, 1970s, 1980s. And I saw an interview with Ann Baxter, and she was really kind of coming to her defense and saying that Betty really had to fight for a lot of the stuff she got, and people didn't give her, producers, and maybe they were like this to a lot of the women, but the people in control, the people in power, didn't make it easy for Betty. And so she, and instead of just kind of going along, she fought back. And so, like, I did watch the Ryan Murphy
Lee feud, I think you mean.
Yeah. Yeah, it was Feud. And it was Susan Sarandon, I believe, portrayed her. And then
Jessica
Lange portrayed Joan Crawford. Or I may have swapped those. But because there was apparently a big feud between those two actresses. And my aha in the kitchen was, there are a segment of our society still today, men and women, I'm not going to stereotype, that enjoy at least women fighting, but definitely conflict, right? We see it a lot in like tabloids, and they'll even do like fights amongst men. But I feel like quite often they will pit one woman against another.
I think you're referring to the entire Real Housewives franchise.
Right, I know. And so yeah, I'm saying, I think there are men and women who enjoy that fight, that argument, that conflict. And so in watching this film, I ask you partway through, did you feel like Eve set out to infiltrate this drama group, like the synopsis says, or did you feel like she kind of accidentally got there, got some kudos, got some accolades, and then the fame maybe went a little bit to her head, which then pitted her against Bette Davis's character, Margot? Right.
And halfway through the film, I would have thought it was a little bit more accidental, but I think then the end of the film, we find out that it was very purposeful, right?
So kudos to Anne Baxter. Was Anne Baxter played Eve?
Yeah.
She played Eve, and she did a great job because she seemed like the, like, ingenue. So one piece of trivia that I thought was sweet and kind of took away a bit of the harshness that I have of Bette Davis, and I feel so bad saying that because I don't know her at all. It's just my perception, and it's also my perception as a young person with an older actress. But she fell in love with her co-star Gary Merrill during the shooting of this film, and they married just weeks after filming completed, and then they adopted a baby girl and they named her Margot, which was her character's name.
Wow.
Isn't that sweet?
Marriage. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, it's kind of interesting because her character in this film is obviously supposed to be angry and bitter. And I don't really, I have to say I know her name, but I don't know her oeuvre. So it's hard for me to say, oh, remember that one time when she played somebody that was fun? So I don't know if it was typecasting or if that was just kind of her wheelhouse. But yeah, I feel sorry if she was a really pleasant, sweet person, because that's not kind of the persona that maybe we came across. And this was an era definitely when the studios had a lot of control over how people appeared, right? The news articles that were written about them and the photographs and everything. So is it as simple as she was fighting with the studio? And so they're like, all right, we're going to make you seem this way. I don't know. It would be curious. I have to say, I struggle to say whether she did a fantastic job or not in this film, because I don't really know much about her, but her portrayal of that character of Margot certainly was kind of bitter and jealous and paranoid and all those things. Not very likable, but that could have been great acting because the character were supposed to be not particularly likable. I think we were supposed to see Eve as the, the pretty young thing that it was innocent, and she's just, so excited to be involved in the movies, or in this case, Broadway at first. And then I liked the twist at the end where somebody Eved Eve, right? So, yeah.
Which probably happens a lot in Hollywood.
Oh, you would think, of course.
Oh, yeah. All the time, yeah.
You stand on top of somebody else to climb up, and then somebody stands on top of you, mm-hmm. right? That's probably just the way it goes. And it is an interesting thing that the tagline said something about women and their men, because in this film, there very much is a difference in kind of the genders. And I think they even talk about that at a certain point. But then there's her friend, Margot's friend, who's kind of the wisecracking one. I couldn't help but think of who did Rosie O'Donnell play in Grease, right?
Rizzo,
yeah. Kind of the same thing, and had a little bit, I think, of that New Jersey kind of East Coast accent as well. So then you say, well, maybe it's not so strictly that. It's just more for the leads, like when Bette Davis and Anne Baxter, because they're going after that leading lady role, they're a certain kind of way. And then you see Margot, she has furs and all this stuff, and then Eve becomes this, I'm just a poor person, but then gets later in the film, she has her own penthouse apartment and her own expensive clothes. So is that just they're commenting on that role of leading actress? Interesting for that time period.
Yeah. I think that in one of the videos I watched, and there's many, so I wish that I had had more time to really dive into it, because I want to give Bette her due. Like, I don't want to not have all the information and categorize mm-hmm. her in a light isn't correct. But one of them said that she very much felt that at 40, you were done. like, and which was kind of, I think, what she was experiencing in Hollywood, that that was the reaction that she was getting, that.
Yeah. I think in that era, especially.
Yeah. Once you hit 40, you were just done and pack up your bags. You're going to play the grandma or if you're lucky. Right. I mean, it's almost like, maybe they, because then that is that embarrassing that a big actress like Betty Davis is just playing a supporting role on, you know, with Marilyn Monroe now playing the
right,
the young ingenue.
So I was thinking, not at all to compare women to horses, but you said put out to pasture. And I was thinking of the same thing, that why wouldn't an actress continue to be able to be a great actress in different roles? But I think at that part, at that time in Hollywood, it was like, okay, you raced in the Preakness or whatever. All right, now you go hang out in a field for the rest of forever. Why? But that, I think probably leading ladies did have that sense of being, and again, kind of like the show pony. They're just go stand over there and look pretty kind of thing. Where maybe if you're a character actress, you had a longer career because, you know, no one would really think as much of a character actress transitioning from the wisecracking little sister to the wisecracking friend to the wisecracking neighbor to the wisecracking grandma. You know what I'm saying? Like, you'd have a different, but it, I'm sure it was incredibly hard on those leading ladies because they were, when they were on top, they were so much on top. And then the fall, when the studio, like you said, probably like your 40th birthday, I'm thinking of Logan's Run, where the crystal goes black in your palm and that's it, you're out, right? That must have been horrible.
Yeah.
And then to see the actors, the men you were acting with, go on to continue in the role of the handsome guy, and they just have, like you said, now a new woman. And you mentioned Marilyn Monroe, and I will be honest, this is amazing. I didn't know she was in this film. I hadn't looked at the credits. And when she walked on screen, I was like, holy, who's that? Right? She captured my eye, not even knowing who she was, in a small part. So it's kind of like, wow, that's some star power, right?
Yeah, it would have been tough back then. I think that, like, women in the studio system back then often were kind of like your behind the scenes people, even on the crew, like the script supervisor. I found out when I was doing research because I was interested in doing that job, that actually a lot of them didn't like being called scripties because it was short for like the scripty girl or something.
Yeah. And diminutive. So the Y was, at
yeah,
the end.
Yeah. It was a pejorative, or maybe not quite a pejorative, but it was definitely to put someone down. The editors were often women because they didn't see that as, which, you know, makes me crazy. They didn't see that as an important part of the filmmaking process, which we know there's the film you write, the film you shoot, and the film you edit.
Okay.
So it's very much
just putting the film together, like, digitally is hard enough. But when you hear,
especially back then,
Dustin talk about the physical craft of putting the film together physically with the cutting and the taping and the, all of the cross checking and how hard it is, that is like ridiculous that it was considered just like an administrative task.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you look at a lot of the films back then in the '50s, the '40s and fifties, oftentimes the editor is a female. Mm-hmm. And then just the costuming, usually that was probably a female driven.
Right.
So it just struck me, 'cause I was like, oh, it was all those men in power. Kind of, I wondered if they enjoy, Joseph Mankiewicz was the writer, and you would, he's probably witnessed this, you know, this type of thing playing out, that the new ingenue comes on and takes over for the.
And there's a line he wrote where Addison DeWitt is talking about Margot, and he said about her first stage appearance. She played a fairy and entered quite unexpectedly stark naked. She's been a star ever since. And I thought, isn't that fascinating? I mean, Mankiewicz put it right in there that she had to play off her sexuality to become a star, right? And we would like to point at, I of course think of Meryl Streep as a person who, to my knowledge, has not done a nude scene. Mm-hmm. That's certainly not the type of role she has taken. And we respect her for her acting ability, rightfully so. Mm-hmm. I don't think that was possible in 1950, right?
Which is interesting and ironic because they couldn't be naked,
right?
Then.
Right. But that was, I think, what at least a leading lady, right?
Right.
A lead actress was expected to, you know, Marilyn Monroe is a great example. Va, va, voom. She oozed sexuality.
You definitely showed your sexuality and your appearance was part of it. But the nudity, I guess I was getting hung up on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the nudity as well. But I think, you know, they did, well, Cleopatra, you mentioned that.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Taylor was in, and I know they, you know, kind of danced around with some of those costumes at the time. And it kind of went back and forth, of course, over the years with the varying mores of the culture and society. But I think, you know, certainly from like the 20s through the 50s, I would say at least, that was kind of, you know, it goes along with you saying it, you're done at 40. There was this very specific role, and this film talks about that, right? And I think that's probably why it resonated with so many people, mm-hmm. is because of that reality.
Mm-hmm. So this is, before I move on to a famous line from this film, 33 years after this film, life imitated art when Ann Baxter stepped into Bette Davis's shoes to replace her on the series Hotel in 1983 after she fell ill and Bette never returned to the show. It was Ann Baxter's part from then on. So that's kind of fascinating that what we saw in this film actually came to pass for these two ladies. And this film is known for the 9th most quoted, as according to the American Film Institute. And I didn't know that this line was from this movie. I knew this line very well. Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Which is fascinating because until I read that trivia, I don't think I had ever heard that phrase before.
You're kidding me.
No, I can't put my finger on it. Yeah, I was like, how is this oft quoted? I don't think I've ever heard somebody say that.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Yeah.
I guess that shows what a film nerd I am because I've heard it quite a bit.
Where we're going, we don't need seatbelts. That one I might know.
You've heard that one. We're deep into the show, but kick us off with your pickup line.
The Sarah Siddons Award for Distinguished Achievement is perhaps unknown to you.
Hmm. Oh, they're at that.
The award show. It opens with the award show. Yeah. And a very long VO from the character Addison DeWitt, who is
off screen at the time, right?
Yes. He's a critic. Well, I think he was at the thing. So I don't know if it's VO or OS. Good question. He's portrayed as a theater critic, but we find out later that he's actually kind of a kingmaker in Broadway. And he chooses whether or not Eve is going to be. And I made a note that he sure is arrogant, his dialogue. But I did like, there's a funny bit in there that the writer who wrote the line put in, because DeWitt says, oh, when he's talking about the awards, he says, minor awards are for such as the writer.
Did you like that line?
I thought that was
fun. Being a writer yourself.
Yeah. I'm sure Mankiewicz was making a comment.
So we talked quite a bit about plot leading up to your pickup line, but let's move into like cinematography. Was there anything in this that you noticed or took note of? It seemed very, I was going to say staged, but it was, you know, it took place largely on a stage.
Right, on a soundstage. I had a couple of notes. One is, was that a 4:3 or a 3:2 aspect ratio? It's very square.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was 4:3. There is a classic Hollywood Vaseline on the filter shot to introduce Celeste Holm. Mm-hmm. I thought that was interesting. And then a lot of panning in the theater at the auditions. I noticed that.
Yes, that's right.
Lots of panning.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. But it did feel a bit, or I should say look a bit like that it was a play that was filmed, right? Mm-hmm. With just kind of the staging and the sets and things,
mm-hmm.
which again makes sense. It's about Broadway people.
Yep. Yep. After this film, which is hard to believe, I need to look up. I'll put in the show notes, everybody. I never saw anywhere that this was her first film, but apparently, kind of her breathy way of speaking and her mannerisms, she adopted as the and Marilyn Monroe was a character kind of.
Happy birthday, Mrs. President. Right.
Yeah. So Marilyn Monroe was a character that Norma Jean played. And apparently after portraying Phoebe in this film, she took on her mannerisms and her breathless voice. So I'm curious where this shows up in her line of credits.
I think this is her first real film. She maybe had a couple bit parts. I thought I read this was her first actual screen line.
Okay, I didn't see that. And usually stuff like that pops up.
Yeah, I could be wrong. And as I said before, I find it fascinating. I was never like a huge fan of Marilyn Monroe. I know that will surprise those of you who think I'm a friend of Dorothy, but I enjoyed the naked photos like everyone else, but it was just like, eh. But she worked on screen in this film. I'm like, okay, I get it. Right?
Well, I mean, to be fair, when we came into awareness of her, I believe she had probably already passed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So she was just like a legend. She was almost
like, I guess that's
like
true for us. She was, yeah.
So we didn't go to the movie and see her. We can now, obviously.
Right. Like I'd seen the photos of her, like with the Great in New York and these mm-hmm. different things. I'd seen her movies. Mm-hmm. I'd seen Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and all of that stuff. So I'd seen her, but I think maybe at that time I was a youngster and I maybe didn't respond like an adult would, mm-hmm. but I was just...
Like an adult man did last weekend.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, wow. Waka, waka.
Waka. Ooga.
Yeah. Ooga. Yeah. The Roger Rabbit eyeballs. Yeah. And I found that so fascinating because of the subject matter of the film.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I know. And she was such a, because in our minds, like you were saying, she's such an icon. But then in the film, she was almost, I don't mean this meanly, but like she was like a nobody. Like yeah. Phoebe's character just she was there and then she was gone.
Just a couple of lines, but one of them was really good. You won't bore him, honey. You won't even get a chance to talk. That was a good line. That Mankiewicz guy had a clever turn of phrase.
Yeah, he did.
I did make note that there was a lot of witty shouting matches. Normally when people get into shouting matches, there's lots of F words and stuff like that. But these people who are witty, they're theater folks.
And it gave you a reason to...
Are you surprised it's taken this long to get into that voice?
I am, yeah.
All right, fair enough.
24 minutes into the podcast. And anything else that you want to chat about before we go into our...
I guess this is maybe a new category of Blackpool Continuity Award. When Bill calls Margot on his birthday, both of their clocks are accurate and they advance accurately throughout the conversation. So the... Blackpool Award for Continuity.
Mad props to the production designers, I guess.
And speaking, though, of sets, there's two things I had to bring up. One is Lloyd has a pipe rack on his credenza.
Ooh.
He has like a half dozen different pipes. And so he has a little rack for them. They're all right next to each other, like a gun rack, but for pipes.
So do you think it's like ladies in their underwear? There's a Monday pipe, a Tuesday pipe, a Wednesday pipe? Or do you think that they're... For our pipe listeners.
Yeah. All of our pipe aficionados.
Write in and tell us. Or like if you know how like, perfect example, coffee. If you're drinking espresso, mm-hmm, you want it finely ground. And if you're drinking kind of like a drip, there's a different kind of. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if with pipes, are there different, tobaccos that you use with different pipes?
I'm going to say yes, because I did, while doing research for National Treasure, or was it Treasure 2, one of the Cage movies, there's a pipe. And so I did a little research about pipes. And the materials of the bowl do matter and have different responses. So I bet there is like, this is for my sweet briar tobacco, and this is for the wacky tobacco. Who knows?
So this is where I could either look for a documentary or I could say, I wonder if somebody has researched this. And folks, that's all I have to say. And in a week, somebody will in my home have researched this and will share the information
with me. To the internets. And the other thing, it was kind of, I guess it's two parts, but about the props at the dinner. So there's a scene where Margot is at dinner with the other couple, and then Addison DeWitt and Eve are at a separate table. And I noticed that the foretop looks incredibly small. It looks like it's a two-top that they jammed all four actors around. And so my note was, were dinner tables actually that small in 1950, or was that for the camera department?
I think that was totally for the camera department, because this is my theory. If you pay attention anytime, even today, anytime a couple is in bed, mm-hmm. it is often a full bed. It's not a queen. It's mm-hmm. not a king. Mm-hmm. And as we know, when you go into most people's homes that you know, the couple has like at least a queen, if not a king.
Sure.
Most people have a king, I would say.
I would say,
but
yeah.
But on TV, if you look.
Right, right.
And it's for the camera, because if you had a husband and wife where they would normally sleep in a king size bed, they wouldn't be in the same shot.
Right.
So
right.
they have to cram. And sometimes it looks ridiculous, like they're in a twin right. bed.
Yeah. Like, I want to totally pull up a shot from the Brady Bunch, because I bet that was like a full or even a twin to put Mike and Carol in the same shot.
I could find countless, yeah. countless, because I notice it all the time. And luckily, I think celebrities are thin people, but and so it works. Right. But I just, sorry, I don't want to sleep in a full bed with anyone.
Yeah.
Even my dog, because he takes up too much room.
Okay, so this is kind of funny. When you said that, it just reminded me, I'd heard this, and I think it's an urban legend, but they said that they had to use a different layout on aircraft to the Polynesian Islands because they were all such big people that you couldn't pack as many in. You had, and I was just thinking, okay, so we should talk to Taika. Like, do the Pacific Islanders, do you have to shoot differently? Because you can't fit as many of them in there, but... Like if you're shooting like a French movie, you can get a lot in the same frame. Who knows? It'd be interesting.
I should look up like Roseanne and Dan's bed and see if it was like a full or if it was bigger.
There were some sturdy actors there. Yeah. Yeah.
Or like Mike and Molly.
I don't. Oh, yeah. That one you might be able to find. I was thinking what was the Matt LeBlanc one? We saw their bed, his most recent sitcom.
I don't remember the name, but I know what you're talking about.
I'm sorry, Mr. LeBlanc. I don't remember. My mind is going LeBlanc on your show name.
Oh, man. All right. With that groaner, was there any head trauma in this film?
There was head trauma. I'm going to give a halvesy, because at one point, Bill grabs Margot by the arms and throws her down on the chaise. So I'm going to go ahead and say that might qualify. And then... Later, Eve laughs at Addison DeWitt, so he slaps her.
How dare you?
And I'm going to say, I think he really slapped the crap out of Ann Baxter.
I bet
that
he did.
Shot looked pretty realistic. Which, by the way, also, both of those land in the couldn't be made today category right. as well.
We can't fake it, sweetie, so he's really going to have to give you one.
Right. There's also nonstop cigarette smoking, which would not be allowed today.
Well, I think in a film it's allowed. What do you mean? It wouldn't be allowed.
Oh, I don't think you
they
can make a film.
They smoke on TV still.
Not at this level. I don't think you could.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely,
And then the thing we cannot forget to mention, because we talked about it for quite a bit during a pause of the movie, is there are 7 lawn jockeys on screen at the same time. Geez. I mean, it was ridiculous. And weren't they indoor? Or are they outdoor? I thought they were indoor.
Yeah.
Like at a club or something. It was just jaw-dropping.
Yes. Yes. Things that it's good that we don't do anymore.
Yes. Wow.
All right. How about a smoochie on to...
Smoochie, smoochie, smoochie.
Better, we have, nicer, sweeter things.
Almost smoochie. Bill almost smooches Margot at the airport gate, and then he gets interrupted, which happens a lot. How often does that happen in real life? I think rarely. I think if you're going to go in for a smooch and your friend walks up, you smooch. Mm-hmm. Your friend can wait 10 seconds.
You complete the smooch.
Yeah.
Agreed.
There might need to be an award like that for completed smooch. I'll have to think about that. Oh, listeners can write in. What movie shows somebody completing the smooch despite the interruption?
Oh, despite, because I'm glad you clarified that. I'm like, every movie we've talked about a smooch. So
yeah, but
you're saying an interrupted smooch that then gets
right.
completed.
Because I actually have a term, almost smoochy, that I have invented for this. Semi-smoochy is when one person is kissing and the other is not. But this is an almost smoochy.
Is there going to be another award show next spring, the Smoochies?
smooches Interruptus. And then there is a real kiss when Karen kisses Lloyd after he wins the award. But that's about it. I would have thought there would be more.
There you go. All right. How about a driving review? Did we see any of these folks drive, or did they just stay on stage?
We did actually see one driving scene. So early on in the film, we see 1946 DeSoto taxi, which was interesting because that's a mid-priced vehicle, pretty nice for a taxi, from the transport when he's leaving to go to LA to direct a movie. That's a Lockheed Constellation known as the Connie to some people. Fascinating four-engined aircraft, very elegant lines. But then there is the scene where Lloyd is taking Margot and his wife to some place and they run out of gas. But Lloyd has poor driving. He puts his hands on the spokes of the wheel, not on the ring. So not only do you have less control, shorter lever arm, but if you happen to hit a pothole or something, you're going to possibly injure yourself even. So cut that out. 10 and 2, outside of the ring, folks. Leave the spoke alone.
I always use the spoke.
Oh, my goodness.
I used both spokes. So I'm like 5 and 7, 4 and 8.
Okay. I think we're going to have to... We're going to have an intervention of some sort for that, but okay.
It looks cool. Shall we go to the numbers?
Let's go to the numbers.
Okay. This film was voted the 21st greatest film of all time by Entertainment Weekly. And in 2007, the AFI ranked it as the 28th greatest film of all time. Mankiewicz based it on an article written by Mary Orr, and she got a whopping $5,000 for the rights to her article titled The Wisdom of Eve.
Okay, what is that $5,000 in today's dollars?
I'm so sorry. I don't have that information for you. Do you want to do some quick Googling
I can do some quick math. Can you...
I can stall.
No, tell me the gross and the adjusted gross.
I don't have that either.
Oh, all right. Okay, listeners, go figure that out.
I can try to... figure it out. I can do it in the show notes. I'll put it in the show notes. Okay. What the $5,000
okay.
would be. Okay. It had a budget of $1.4 million. Oh, and it brought in $8.4 million domestically. And I guess they weren't sharing films worldwide in 1950 because it only brought in $2,348 worldwide. So, but they did good here in the States. IMDb gives it an 8.3 out of 10. This is a very popular movie with critics, 99%, and audiences give it a 94%. It was 2 hours and 18 minutes, a bit long for us folks. I believe we had at least one potty break.
That is well past the moral line.
It was before we rated films, so it passed.
Okay.
It's listed as a drama. It's a 20th Century Fox film, and it won 27 awards and got 20 nominations. George Sanders won for an Oscar for Best Actor and a supporting role. Mankiewicz won for screenplay and directing. Edith Head, who is a very, very famous costume designer, won for Best Costumes, and Daryl Zanuck won for Best Picture. So he must have been the producer on that.
Is Edith Head the person that was the basis of the costume lady in The Incredibles? I think she was called Edith.
Yes, yeah. I believe so. Yes, you are correct. And we watched this on Apple, so we paid a whopping $3.99 to be able to watch it. And speaking of watching, let's see what we're going to watch next week.
Walk the line.
Okay, cool. So have a great weekend. Enjoy the movies that you watch, and we'll see you back here next Sunday. But never forget,
Dodges never stop, and neither do the movies.
Thanks for listening to Dodge Movie Podcast with Christy and Mike Dodge of Dodge Media Productions. To find out more about this podcast and what we do, go to dodgemediaproductions.com. Subscribe, share, leave a comment, and tell us what we should watch next. Dodges never stop, and neither do the movies.